Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly, or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly, or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly, or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly, or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
You know, Governor, it has been said, though, that no candidate was picked on and made fun of as much as you were.
Oh, there's so much bull crap out there about my family, about my record, about my state, and it really hurts when I hear the negativity about the state of Alaska and of course, my family. So a lot of bull.
That's an excerpt from Barbara Walters' recent interview with Sarah Palin. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Why does Sarah Palin not only generate such interest, but among many, I dare say, I mean, at least just looking at it from a political standpoint, she's a divisive figure for some reason. Why is this? Why so much animosity toward Governor Sarah Palin? We'll begin the first segment talking with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse about the media and Sarah Palin. And then a little bit later in the program, Dr. Kim Riddlebarger will join us. We'll talk with him about lessons learned from the fall of Rome. What could American Christians learn from our ancient counterparts when their empire was crumbling? Also with Jennifer Roback Morse, we'll talk about Catholic Charities and a proposed same-sex marriage law in Washington, D.C. You can join us for the next hour of Issues Etc. We're coming to you live this Tuesday. It's the 17th of November, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. You can use our in-studio email address. We get those questions right here in real time. talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org, or you can Twitter us at @issuesetc. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is founder of the Ruth Institute, based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She's authored the books Smart Sex and Love and Economics. Jen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Why do you think Sarah Palin generates so much animosity?
Well, she is a lightning rod for two different visions of what it means to be a modern woman. And the kind of woman that Sarah Palin represents, the woman who values children and family and husband, and who also may want an education and career, but the woman who primarily wants family and husband and children and all of those kinds of things, that kind of woman has always known that the radical feminist movement was directed against her. And now the behavior of the mainstream media, particularly the media elites on the East Coast, those people have proven beyond any shadow of a doubt that they are not there to advocate for women per se or women as such. They are there to advocate for a particular vision of womanhood. And their vision of womanhood is that women belong in the workplace, that children are a consumer good that is completely optional and that should not interfere with your job. Their vision of sex is that sex is principally a sterile activity that doesn't necessarily result in children, and that your first priority really is to participate in the labor force and to be as much like a man as possible. And so when somebody like Sarah Palin comes along who says, you know, I'm competent, I can handle myself, I can handle my job, I can handle the state of Alaska, I can handle a gun, I can handle my kids. You know, she doesn't uplift that kind of feminist. She's a rebuke to them because she proves that it's possible for a woman to be competent inside the workforce without renouncing her family and her marriage and all those other things. And so she makes very, very clear that modern feminism has basically been based on a kind of fraud against women, a kind of false advertising, claiming that they speak for all women, whereas in fact they do no such thing. In fact, modern feminism speaks for a very small number of very radical people.
Explain this to me, though, because in so many ways, Sarah Palin, if you were just to examine her in a completely objective way, lay aside all the political considerations, what she's had to say, and the role she's played in American politics. Here's a woman who's a governor, seems like a kind of feminist ideal. She has a political career, writes books. She has managed to, quote unquote, have it all, a family, a husband, children, pretty typical family there. How does she not qualify in the eyes of the feminists? I'm still trying to sort that one out, because if you lay aside her political views and perhaps her religious and moral views, you do have kind of the model of feminist achievement, don't you?
But you see, that model of feminist achievement was always a ploy, Todd. That's what I believe. I mean, and I think their behavior now demonstrates beyond any shadow of a doubt that claim was really a ploy. That's what they put up there to make their vision appealing, to say, you know, look, we're in favor of women achieving their highest potential. Well, if that's what you believe, then you should love Margaret Thatcher and Sarah Palin every bit as much as you love Gloria Steinem. But of course, as you rightly note, they do no such thing. They don't care about Sarah Palin. They hate Sarah Palin. And so now we have to ask, well, why is that? What does she represent to them that makes her such a threat to them? And I believe it comes right down to the thing we love to talk about in this program, Todd, which is sex. And the vision of sex of the radical feminists is that gender itself is some kind of cosmic accident or a cosmic injustice that we're supposed to wipe out in all possible ways, and that the sexual act is meant to be a sterile act. And so in order to create the kind of world they want, where men and women are basically interchangeable in the labor force, you've got to wipe out the reproductive consequences of sex and make and completely neutralize that whole part of human life. And Sarah Palin is a very fertile woman. She's a woman who embraces reproductive sex and fertile sex and working and collaborating with her husband. She is not a gender-neutral person. She's just not. And so I think that the reason she generates so much hostility is that she is revealing to everybody that what that brand of feminism was promoting was never really true. You know, and what they're trying to promote, I think we've talked about this before, Todd, but they have a Marxist vision of the struggle between men and women as simply being a special case of class struggle between the bourgeois and the proletariat, and the wife is the proletariat in the Marxist vision. And so they have used that gender struggle as a vehicle for having the state be involved in various aspects of people's private lives, even while they're saying, oh, privacy, 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 let's have abortion, let's have abortion. In fact, what they've ended up with is a world in which childbearing has become almost completely a woman's private responsibility with the help of the state. Why? Because the fathers have been marginalized from the family. In policy after policy, the men have been pushed aside from the family. And so if you want to have a child, you kind of have to have the partnership of the state. Well, that's what the Marxist mentality wants to have, is not private collaboration between fathers and mothers, but a public collaboration between the state and the mother. And so she makes it very clear that what they said they were promoting and what they're actually promoting are really quite different things. And in fact, when a woman, when the two different kinds of women sort of meet in the dating market or in the marriage market, women like Sarah Palin, women like our women that we work with the Ruth Institute, who want to go through college and be chaste, those women are at a serious disadvantage in the mating market, because what they want to do is postpone sex until marriage, get married, have kids, stay married. That's what they want to do, but they're trying to get a date with guys who also have as an option women who are willing to abort their babies at the drop of a hat. You know, so if you say, look, you know, you can. I want to go out with you, but I don't want to have sex with you. And if we do have sex, I expect you to marry me if I get pregnant. You know, that's a non-starter, because he can go find a woman who will have sex with him and abort the baby. So the conflict or the competition between those two types of women, it's been there from the beginning. Phyllis Schlafly saw it. That's how Phyllis Schlafly got hundreds of women to show up in state house lawns to protest the Equal Rights Amendment. So that conflict has been part of the modern version of feminism from the very beginning. And Sarah Palin is now a lightning rod for it. And I just don't think there's any doubt about it. I think what we need to do is to make it very clear that the feminist movement, as it has been understood in the late 20th century, is basically a fraud, using women as a front to advance a leftist agenda. And you just can't look at Sarah Palin and think that you're somehow going to pass her, you know, through that Marxist filter. She's not going to fit. And so they have to destroy her, because she's appealing on her own terms. And she draws women to her. Women love her. So many women are crazy about her. My hairdresser loves her. My fellow academics love her. You know, there are a lot of women who really find her appealing and inspiring. And the left can't stand that. And so, therefore, they have to destroy her.
With only 30 seconds, it seems like her kids are fair game as well. I mean,
that's appalling, isn't it? I mean, you know, really, isn't that just the lowest thing that you have ever seen in American politics, the way they have gone after her kids? I mean, these people should be read out of public life for doing that kind of stuff. I can't believe some of these people still have their jobs. It's just appalling.
Folks, I want to hear from you about the media and Sarah Palin. Our in-studio email address on this Tuesday afternoon, November the 17th, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our studio number, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. You can always Twitter us at @IssuesETC. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is founder of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She'll be with us on the other side of the break. Talk more about Sarah Palin and the media, also Catholic Charities and a proposed same-sex marriage law in Washington, D.C. 1-877-623-6943. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason University. She's author of the book Smart Sex and Love in Economics. You can purchase both of these books under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Click on demand. When we come back, I want to stay with the kids a little bit, because it seems to me that at least one of the daughters is by hook or crook, by immaturity and rebellion, living the feminist ideal, and she's also roundly condemned by the feminists for it. What gives? We'll be right back.
Are you looking for a church where you can receive the gifts of God in the gospel and the sacraments and in the church's historic worship with lively music? Then come to Hope Lutheran Church in South St. Louis. We're located on the corner of Brannan and Neosho Streets at 5218 Neosho. You can also reach us on the World Wide Web at www.hopelutheranstl.org and give us a call at 314-352-0014. There is hope in St. Louis.
These days, value affords me a new attitude. It lets me appreciate that I can start my day with more than a $6 cup of coffee, and that I officially have permission to skip dinner out to spend time talking with my family over Casserole Inn. Concordia Publishing House offers Christian products that help me focus on what matters most. Visit any of the three Concordia bookstores downtown in Kirkwood and on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, or shop online at cph.org and find out what a new value attitude looks like in your life.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
We know that many congregations are putting together their budgets for next year. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc. to your congregation's mission or advertising budget for 2010. Simply go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org, and find out more about the Issues, Etc. 300. You'll even find a one-page flyer that you can hand out. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues, Etc. The Issues, Etc. 300.
Here's a great resource for Sunday school teachers. Every Tuesday, we interview Deaconess Pam Nielsen of Concordia Publishing House about the upcoming Growing in Christ Sunday school lesson. You'll find these interviews under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Listen to a 20-minute interview with Pam Nielsen, and you'll be prepared to teach Sunday school this weekend. issuesetc.org. Click on demand and look for Teaching a Sunday School Lesson with Deaconess Pam Nielsen. Issues, Etc. online at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Sarah Palin and the media in a moment with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse. We'll talk about Catholic Charities in D.C. and a proposed same-sex marriage law in the nation's capital. 1-877-623-MYIE. Talk back at issuesetc.org or our Twitter address at issuesetc. Jennifer, you said before it is an outrage that the children have been fair game in the media's attacks on Sarah Palin as well. And I got to wonder again, in parallel with what I asked before about mom, one of the daughters, hooks up with a guy. She gets pregnant out of wedlock. What did she do wrong, according to the feminists?
Well, that's a very good question. You know what? Because that situation is a situation that feminists never condemn, a situation that so many feminists basically have tried to achieve because, I mean, after all, she's independent of the guy. And as far as I can tell, the complaint against that daughter is not so much a complaint against the daughter, but a complaint against Christian conservatives being hypocritical, look, she's supposed to be, 100% chaste and abstinent and all that kind of stuff, and look here, see what she went and did. She got pregnant. So, it doesn't really quite make sense or add up, but it's really more an attack on her mother than an attack on her, at least as far as I can understand it. But to use a child, to use a young person, a person that age, to go after somebody politically, that is really, really beyond the pale. And it used to be considered bad form by everybody in American public life. Even the mafia would not go after people's kids like that. You know what I mean? I mean, we're really reaching a new low here, as far as the vulgarity and just coarseness of public life.
One more quick question on Sarah Palin. What would she have to do to win the good graces of American feminism? About 30 seconds.
Completely convert to becoming a card-carrying member of NARAL. As far as I can tell, that's all she could do. I don't think there's anything she could do that would make them happy.
Love and marriage, love and marriage. It's an institute you can't disparage.
The other subject we wanted to raise with Jennifer, while we have her, has to do with Catholic Charities in Washington, D.C., and a warning they have issued about a proposed same-sex marriage law in the nation's capital. These Catholic Charities, Jennifer, I mean, come on, can't they just stick to helping poor people and stay out of political issues like same-sex marriage?
Well, it'd be nice if they could, but in fact they can't, because what the D.C. City Council is proposing to do is to basically say you're not eligible to receive city contracts unless you comply with the non-discrimination bills that they're putting into place, and one of those includes being willing to place children in same-sex couples, adoptive children and foster children with same-sex couples, and a whole variety of other requirements as well. And so it's not that that Catholic Charities is saying, do it our way or the highway. Basically, the city council is saying our way or the highway. The Catholic Charities basically wants to continue doing what it's always done, but if the law goes through as it is being proposed, they will no longer be eligible to apply for city contracts. And as I understand it, there's some $8 million in city contracts that the Catholic diocese in one way or the other receives from the city to provide a whole variety of services, and they'll no longer be eligible for those contracts. Now, the Archdiocese will continue to contribute its own resources also, as it has been doing, and it's my understanding that they contribute about $10 million of their own members' contributions in addition to thousands and thousands of volunteer hours. That will all continue, as far as I know, unless the city council has something else up its sleeve to keep them from even doing that. But the reality is it's the city council that's pulling the fast one here and trying to make it look like the like there's something wrong with Catholic Charities. In fact, they are the ones saying, we're about to pass a bill, and you need to change your behavior, or we're not going to let you even apply for city contracts.
Is this a small print version of something that's going to inevitably be writ much larger when it comes to issues of Catholic Charities nationwide and the goals of same-sex marriage advocates nationwide?
This is not a small print version. This is it. This is what's going to happen. I mean, what we're looking at here is, you know, over half of the budget of D.C. City, you know, the Archdiocese of D.C. Is basically at stake. And what they're going to do, what the city council is going to have to do is pull that money and find somebody else to give it to perform those services. Now, maybe they have up their sleeve some other more efficient provider of services, but, you know, saying the word D.C. City Council and efficient in the same sentence is not usually a good thing to say. I doubt very seriously they have somebody else up their sleeve who's going to take up the slack that quickly. This is precisely what is at stake. And when you think about it, in the city of in the District of Columbia, same-sex couples make up 1.5% of all households in the city of the district. And so that means, for the sake of that 1.5% of the households, they're basically going to throw under the bus the largest private social service provider in the city. That seems to me to be quite petty on the side of the city council and on the side of the gay lobby. But they're turning around and trying to say that Catholic Charities is being petty. Well, no, the Catholic Charities is being what it has always been. It is they who are making a new and really truly unprecedented demand on private social services providers.
Is this a stunt, or do you think that the D.C. City Council actually believed they could get Catholic Charities to capitulate?
I don't know what they think. I think they know that they're not going to get the city to capitulate, or the diocese to capitulate. The question is whether they're going to back down. I mean, you know, I'm not close enough to the scene. As you know, I'm in San Diego. I'm as far away from the Beltway as it's possible to be in the continental U.S., and that's the way I like it. So, I wouldn't venture a guess as to who's going to back down. But I know the Archdiocese is not going to back down. They'd close everything down before they do that, but they don't have to close it down. They're just going to operate in a truncated version, of what they currently do. They're going to continue to preach the gospel and serve the poor. But the city is going to have to do something else. It's the citizens of the city of Washington that are going to be harmed. And I think it's quite shocking and really appalling that within the city of Washington, the black pastorate of the city are very much opposed to same-sex marriage. There are a lot of very vocal African-American pastors who don't want any part of redefining marriage, but the city council and the political class within the district is so beholden to Democratic politicos that they are that they're going to go along with this because this is what they're being told to do. But their constituents absolutely don't want it. Their natural constituents don't want it. And I think it's very interesting that Obama, who was elected by overwhelming support of African American voters, what those voters are finding out is that he is taking them for granted. He thinks that they won't leave him, that he doesn't have to do anything to make them happy, that he's going to be able to keep them on his side no matter what he does, and he's going to throw them under the bus and make nice with the gay lobby, who also gave him a lot of money and a lot of support. And so I think there are a lot of I'm hearing African American voters who are having buyer's remorse about the first black president, that he's taking them for granted as voters, and I think it's going to be very interesting to see how African-American voters respond to that. Because in a sense, it's a sign of political maturity to say, you know, I don't care if you're black or white. If you're going to treat me badly, I'm not voting for you. You know, the African-American community has not always been able to do that. They've not felt that it was possible for them to do that. And, you know, now in a certain way, they've come of age. And certainly in D.C., you know, all the major politicians in D.C. are African-Americans. So I think it's possible that some opposition, a social conservative opposition to Obama's style of policies could emerge out of this whole thing. I think that's going to be very interesting to watch long term, to be quite honest with you.
Folks, when you surf the web tonight, check out the website for Jennifer Roback Morse and the Ruth Institute. You'll find a link at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on demand and look for Jennifer Roback Morse and the Ruth Institute. Dr. Morse is founder of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of the books Smart Sex and Love and Economics. Jennifer, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to be talking about lessons learned from ancient history. Now, this is ancient history, the fall of the Roman Empire. Oh, they knew that it was coming. They watched it happen. And as far as many at the time were concerned, the world was coming to an end. This was civilization itself coming unraveled. And of course, in the mix was a very early legal Christianity. And some concluded that Christianity would go the way that the Roman Empire went. As Rome went, so went Christianity. They had a bit of confusion. Others said, namely Augustine, no. In fact, he's almost forced into a position that he would have probably come at biblically in any other respect, and that is the kingdom of God and the kingdom of men are two different things. The city of God, the city of men, two different things. And that distinction finds its way into the Reformation, is honed there with good biblical friction, and then emerges for us. So why is it that today in America, Christians feel the same way about the American empire, if you will, the American enterprise, as the Romans, the ancient Roman Christians, may have felt about the Roman Empire, that the two are somehow coterminous, that America's successes are the church's successes, or at least Christendom's successes, and that if America is on the decline, that maybe Christianity is too. We'll try and clear up that confusion. Dr. Kim Riddlebarger of the White Horse Inn will be our guest in the last half hour of Issues Etc. on this Tuesday afternoon, November the 17th. I'm Todd Wilkin. We'll be right back. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. St. John Lutheran, Springfield, Pennsylvania. Zion Lutheran, Detroit, Michigan. St. Paul's Lutheran, Long Beach, California. All Saints Lutheran, Charlotte, North Carolina. Redeemer Lutheran, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Shepherd of the Lake Lutheran, Garrison, Minnesota. Emmanuel Lutheran, Kansas City, Missouri. And Holy Cross Lutheran, St. Genevieve, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Now, only our listeners can cancel us. You're listening to Issues Etc.
One Doctor's Story.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Dr. Matt Anderson has seen his share of post-abortive women. As an OBGYN, he inquires about previous pregnancies on the first visit with a mother-to-be. Writing for World Magazine, he emphasizes that women continue to deal with the pain years later, a pain often denied by abortion advocates. He says as women continue to be victimized by abortion, mainstream medicine ignores the long-term negative mental health risks it poses. The politics of abortion advocacy has tainted medical research into claiming safety and no long-term adverse mental effects for a procedure that takes a pre-born human life.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.